We'll proceed to the sixth case, the United States versus Farris. Ms. Dyson.
May it please the court, Mr. Cox. My name is Carol Dyson, and I represent the defendant in this matter, Travis Farris. And in this case before the court today, Mr. Farris was convicted of bank robbery, conspiracy to commit bank robbery, possession of a firearm in furtherance of a felony, and mail fraud. These convictions were supported or in part by the testimony of a co-defendant, Matthew Courtney. In this case, Matthew Courtney's testimony is so unreasonable that it is insufficient to support these convictions. We'll start with the bank robbery. At the time that this offense was committed, Mr. Farris had enlisted in the armed forces. As part of his obligation with the armed forces, he had to attend DEP functions, delayed entry program functions. They were held every Saturday and usually started at 10 a.m. In fact, the day of the bank robbery was the last DEP function before Mr. Farris would be shipped off to basic training. Testimony at trial indicated that the bank robbery occurred at 9:47. Testimony at trial also indicated a certain distance and time that it would take to get from the bank all the way to where the DEP function was being held. Now, Mr. Farris was also enlisting with his two brothers and a cousin, and the testimony is undisputed that Mr. Farris
did. The jury heard all this evidence, though, and apparently believed in cahoots and did it.
But
this sounds like an argument to make the jury.
I understand that, but I think that the jury got it wrong in this case because it was impossible for Mr. Farris to rob the bank and make it to the DEP function. Sergeant Smith, who ran the DEP function, testified that they started at 10. He said it is possible it could have started at 10:20, but on that particular day, he does not recall the DEP function starting late. He does recall all four of the Farrises arriving at the same time. The government argues that that testimony, particularly by the brothers and by Sergeant Smith, is not as reliable because of certain inconsistencies, who drove and in what car that they arrived in. I don't think that those inconsistencies matter, and I think that those inconsistencies are expected when you're talking about the length of time from the event and that everyone testified.
How long did it take to get from the bank to the Does it take to get from the bank to the VFW hall?
I think, Your Honor, if I recall, it could take as much as 20 minutes. If you're driving it straight. From the video surveillance indicated that the robbery occurred at 9:47. Now, according to Mr. Courtney, after they left the bank, they stopped at his trailer, his residence, so that he could pick up his car. They then drove to Mr. Farris's father's garage. They had to split up the money. And then from that point on, Mr. Farris had to meet up with his other relatives to go to the DEP function. And it is undisputed that all of them arrived together. As I indicated, some inconsistencies are expected, what car you went in. But I believe that given the fact that this is the last DEP function before the young men would be sent to basic training, everyone would have remembered if they had started late. It was important that they start on time. And Sergeant Smith, out of all of the witnesses, has no reason to be biased either for or against the defendant, does not recall the function starting late. The government
does he affirmatively say, Ms. Dyson, that it started on time? Or does he just leave it open that day?
I think that he leaves it open, but the reasonable inference is that had it started late, he would have recalled that.
Was there examination of how regular or regularly they had a variance in time? I mean, how many meetings were there in this program before basic?
I think that the DEP functions began at the end of the prior year, and it was once every Saturday. So there were a number of DEP functions to indicate whether or not. I think that Sergeant Smith indicated that on prior occasions the functions had started late, and then he would sit and wait. And if someone came too late, he would ultimately began the function. But I think that that occurrence is a memorable thing, and I think that someone, particularly Sergeant Smith, would remember whether or not it started late. So I believe the reasonable inference is they did not start late. The government also presented evidence of cell phone calls, which in no way placed Mr. Ferris at the DEP function. Evidence from the defendant indicated that Mr. Ferris' cell phone was with his wife. And if you look at the phone calls back and forth between Mrs. Ferris, her sister-in-law, and the other members of her husband's family, it would seem it makes no sense that Mr. Ferris would be at this DEP function making all of these calls. There was testimony from Sergeant Smith that he has no recollection that any phone calls were made during this DEP function. Admittedly, there is no requirement that you leave your cell phone at the door at these functions. It is disruptive if someone is making several telephone calls while they're proceeding with this function, and then there was no indication that any such phone calls had been made. With respect to the charge of mail fraud, this involved the burning of Defendant Ferris's IKEA vehicle, which was ultimately located in southern Illinois. It was only the testimony of Matt Courtney that put him down there. In this instance, the government also submitted telephone records, but again, because the phone was down in southern Illinois, it doesn't necessarily mean that Mr. Ferris himself was down in southern Illinois. There was evidence on behalf of the defendant to indicate that Mr. Courtney, in fact, had Mr. Ferris's his telephone. I'd also like to briefly address sentencing in this matter. In the United States v. Booker, the U.S. Supreme Court has now provided district courts with greater authority to use their discretion in sentencing under 3553. District courts are no longer held to the rigid standards set by the sentencing guidelines. In this case, I believe that the district court failed to give proper weight to the mitigating evidence submitted in this case. Mr. Ferris was a young man, a young family, no prior criminal record. In this case, it's a little different because the district court is in an interesting position where they can view someone's behavior and pattern after the offense. Because of the way the offense happened and Mr. Ferris was arrested some time later, the court was able to see that Mr. Ferris joined the Army, wanted to fight for his country, and did not commit any other criminal offenses. I think in this case, Your Honor, a sentence below the guideline range of 63 months would be appropriate. Additionally, Mr. Ferris was also convicted of the 924C possession of the firearm. That's a mandatory minimum that must run consecutive. And I think that you have to look at a sentence as a whole, not just the 63 months for the other charges, but you have to look at the additional 7 years because that's what he's going to be serving. And I think that in this case, a sentence of 12 years was excessive. I'll save the rest of my time, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Dyson. Mr. Cox.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Richard Cox on behalf of the United States. Ms. Dyson says that the jury's verdict in this case was unreasonable, and of course that's not the standard of review. It's could a rational trier of fact have found sufficient evidence to convict Mr. Ferris of these crimes, and obviously by its verdicts it did. And in fact it found Mr. Ferris not guilty of one of the counts. So I think this does show that the jury carefully weighed the evidence that was presented to it, and returned appropriate verdicts, not unreasonable verdicts. Essentially, Ms. Dyson argues that the evidence was not believable. Well, really what she's saying is it's not credible, which, of course, is the province of the jury, and the jury resolved those credibility issues, apparently, against Mr. Ferris. She presents the alibi defense as if it was an immutable fact of nature, and, of course, there was all sorts of conflicting testimony about that. That was, again, for the jury to resolve. The jury did resolve that, apparently, in the favor of the government by finding Mr. Ferris guilty of that offense. If the court has no questions concerning the facts, I won't waste your time detailing the facts that we believe support that finding by the jury, and then just turn to the sentencing argument that Ms. Dyson makes. Of course, the government asked and thought that a reasonable sentence in this case, in addition to the 924C sentence of 84 months, was an additional 78 months, which was the top of the guidelines range. And the judge disagreed with the government and found that the bottom of the guideline range, 63 months, was reasonable in this case. He laid out his reasons for why that was a reasonable sentence. He carefully considered all of the mitigation evidence that Ms. Dyson presented, the high school graduation of Mr. Ferris, his loving and supportive family, the fact that he was in the military. All of these factors were presented to the judge, commented upon the judge, considered by the judge, and he simply disagreed with the weight that, and value that Ms. Dyson believes should have been accorded to that. And that's really not a basis to determine that his sentence was unreasonable. So for all of those reasons, Your Honor, unless you have any questions, I would ask you to affirm the judgment and sentence of the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Cox.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Dyson?
I have nothing else in rebuttal, Your Honors, if you have any questions for me.
I think not. In addition to obviously thanking you and Mr. Cox for your presentation this morning, Ms. Dyson, I want to give you an additional thanks from the court for accepting this appointment and representing Mr. Ferris. Case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.